I want to finish a little bit on the back of here. Finish a little bit with the presuppositional trajectories for proving the existence of God. And I noticed on this one that I didn't complete some sentences. So,
like where it says, this is by no means.
Yes. A complete list.
That's what I think what that should say.
And on the websites, they're going to be the most current and spell checked and grammar checked and detailed. This actually got expanded to 9 pages as I start going it to fill it out. Okay. So, a couple things, just as you can kind of see down through here, it's kind of some of the summary of what it talked about with presuppositional apologetics. That I'm going to talk about the ontological argument next week. There's 3 very old arguments for the existence of God. And the ontological, not the same as oncological, but the ontological has to do with being, existence. And so, with the rational necessity, and I'll see that again a little more next time, that reason requires the existence of a transcendental, eternal, omnipotent creator. Reason demands that. And then we'll see being itself, existence, demands the existence of a creator. Transcendental means it's outside of space and time. One of the theories for the universe is that we're now in the multiverse kind of idea. A lot of things where there's up to an infinite number of universes out there, but they all came from the Big Bang. But some of those have developed aliens that can create the enormous, can also create universes. There's designer universe. Ours happens to be one of those designer universes where everything is just right for life.
One of these aliens is our God.
Yeah. Well, there is no God.
Because he created it.
As a creator, yeah. So then there's the preconditions for intelligibility. Big fancy phrase, just meaning resources for meaning. How is it we can understand the meaning of anything? And there's certain preconditions we have to have. I put up the equation E equals MC squared. Well, half the population on the planet probably would have no idea what that even means. They don't have the pre-existing resources to make meaningful sense out of that equation. So, for everything, how is it that we can even, in our minds, add 2 and 2 and come up with 4? Well, it's education. Well, but everybody on the planet can do it. Where does that come from? So there's preconditions. And so for anything to be meaningful, a transcendent, eternal, omnipotent creator is required. He is the one that provides the meanings. And that's where the AIIUs come from. Abstract, immaterial, invariant, universal objects. There's things that exist that don't have any basis in the physical world. Like numbers, like beauty. And there's a whole list of them on the part one of the apologetics concepts. So all those things. And then, again, those are transcendentals. They don't exist in space and time. Numbers don't exist now, but they didn't 1,000 years ago, or they won't in 1,000,000 years from now. Numbers exist outside of space and time. That's because ultimately all of these things, all of these AIIUs come from God. They're part of the mind of God. And then there's impossibility of the contrary.
And that says that if we have two things or more, and I'll get into that probably next time, that if we have A and B, if A and B are the only possibilities, and it's pretty universally acknowledged that creation and evolution are the only two possibilities. There is no third alternative. So if one of them is true, the other is false. If one of them is false, by default, the other is true. That's the impossibility of the contrary. We prove evolution is false. By definition, the only other option is a creator. Impossibility of the contrary. And a lot of don't like that because they say, well, there's no positive evidence or something like that. But again, if there's only two possibilities and one of them is false, then the other one, by default, is true. That's Sherlock Holmes said something like that. When you weigh out all the evidence and everything proves false, the remaining conclusion, no matter how strange, is probably the truth.
That's why that book, Altenburg 16, is so exciting to me, because it is evolutionists who are caving in on Darwinism. They're saying it can't be true. And so they're desperately searching for some other basis to explain everything, but yes. They're saying this won't be taught in public schools for another 50 years, but we already know it's dead.
Because the dogma of Darwinism is well established, and the science is crumbling very seriously. Anyway, that's so. And so then the creation itself justifies, that's Romans 1. God has built it into his creation and into his humans made in his image to be able to understand that creation. And so creation itself justifies. And then I want to talk about the don't answer strategy. Somebody look up Proverbs 26, please. That's the one I do. I want to do real quick. It's Proverbs 26, 4 and 5.
Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes.
Some critics have used that as one of the contradictions of the Bible. But it has there's a different connotation in each part of it. So the don't answer strategy works like this. You say to me, well, the Bible is full of contradictions. What's the normal response?
Show me one.
Show me the one, exactly. And that's okay for a little while, but we're, in doing that, we are answering the fool according to his folly. We are going into his territory. He has set the rules of engagement. And when we go in there, we justify. A whole lot of atheists won't do debates anymore because they look bad. And they give us credibility. And that's the big, it's not that they look bad that's the real problem, is that they don't want to even give us the time of day, because every time we get a platform, we generally look pretty good. And they generally look pretty bad. So when somebody says the Bible is full of contradictions, the response is, well, I completely reject your claim. There's a little in there, I completely disagree with whatever it is. But we reject it. And it takes a little bit of boldness. I just completely reject that. But then the other half of it is, answer a fool according to folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. So let's take your worldview and your claim, and let's look at it. Let's assume it's true for a minute. Let's take a look at it. So, according to your worldview, why are contradictions wrong? What's the matter with contradictions? All we are is chemistry and physics. There's no truth. There's no ultimate reality. There's just chemistry and physics. So, what's the big deal with contradictions? And who are you to say that something is a contradiction? On what basis do you make such a judgment? And so we go after that and extend that out to its logical conclusion, depending on what they're going to do. And I think everybody should do whatever they want.
Well, I completely reject that, Cody, but let's say you're right. Let's say that should be the way everything is done. Then I should be able to do whatever. Let's pull out a gun. I don't like you. You're dead. According to your worldview, what's wrong? What's the problem? But see, as a Christian, I have an absolute standard, a basis of judgment. There is an almighty creator God who set those standards, and I can answer that question. What's wrong with torturing children? Or genocide? Oh, genocide is evil. Well, I completely reject that claim, but why? According to your worldview, what's wrong with it? What's wrong with it? According to your religion, this applies if you're dealing with Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, whoever, it works the same way.
Why? Why does it work with those groups?
Because it's the same strategy. You have to know
the strategy.
And so this is a strategy. It's not specific to creation, evolution, or atheism, or anything like that. It's a general strategy. As Christians, we have a standard to make judgments. And it's an absolute standard. Murder is wrong because the Creator God has set that standard.
So the strategy being just reject that claim or premise outright, but then
yes,
entertain it to take it to its logical conclusion. That's the strategy you're talking about. And you can use that in a variety of contexts.
Yes, and it's very useful. But the first step is to make sure they understand I reject that.
Well, and then the second part is you're going sort of past it. Instead of going, oh, well, here's a contradiction, here's why they contradict, because we know all the contradictions eventually work out with God, like whatever it is.
Yes.
And half the time they're both, and that's just the way God is. But the going past it, so you're not actually diving into all those part of the detail, but going past to, you know, why is the contradiction? Why does that have meaning to you? Why is there a foundation for those kind of ideas?
On what basis do you even make that claim in the first place? And so we push it, and that's part of getting them to see, lest he be wise in his own eyes. We're trying to get these people from whatever background that we're dealing with to see the folly of their own position. I mean, they probably won't change, but probably nobody's ever done it like that before. And this is why the part of the title of this class is speaking like Jesus when they said, is it lawful to pay taxes or not? Show me a coin. He completely went around the whole issue of taxation to deal with who is it that we are serving. And that's, he did a lot of questions like that. This woman had a husband and he had seven brothers and they all died, and in the resurrection, who is she gonna, whose husband? Well, you do err, not knowing the scriptures of our God. He's the God of the living, not the God of the dead. He just went around it in a completely different way, and it's a different way of thinking. When somebody asks us a question, we want to get with the question. Specifically, just pause a second. Okay, how are we going to do this end run here? Because that's almost always. There's a famous author named Saul Alinsky. Anybody ever heard of him or not heard of him?
Oh, yeah.
My brother gave me the book, actually, and I looked at it. The introduction says, dedicated to Lucifer, the first rebel who won for himself a kingdom. It kind of tells you where this guy's... And it's called Rules for Radicals. And one of his things that he says is, the issue is never the issue. So whatever the media is focusing on, that's to get your attention, because there's a knife headed towards your back. It's to divert your attention to something else. And so we want to know, what is the real issue?
And then sometimes that takes the Holy Spirit. And this person, what is it that's the real issue? Where is that key that the Holy Spirit wants to use to unlock their heart? And sometimes there's just a big roadblock in their head, and they need some help getting over it. And it's very rarely exactly what they're saying. It's something else. And so this answer, don't answer strategy helps to break that. Big word that gets thrown around is deconstruction. Its actual origin is destructive, with no intention of constructing something else. God told Jeremiah, I'm going to use you to tear down kingdoms and build up kingdoms. So he's doing a deconstruction, but then the nature of God is always redemptive. Let's rebuild something better according to how I want it, instead of how, why this thing needs judgment now, and we got to fix it or change it or start with something completely new. In deconstruction, most of the time when you hear it in the world, it is for the intent of destroying. I'm going to play a clip. You won't be able to see it very well, but it's on here. It's Stephen Hicks on explaining postmodernism in 2018. You can find it on YouTube. It's 2.5 hours long. It's a very long span analysis of history and key players and how we got to where we are. He's not a Christian. Yeah, as far as I can tell, he's atheist. But he's laying out point by point. And this is the section in here, the first generation of postmoderns from the 50s. And it is from them and their students came the hippie rebellion of the 60s. It didn't just happen by accident. It was set up, and you'll hear this in a second, that college professors viewed themselves as activist makers. Our purpose is no longer to teach students how to think, but how to be activists. And the whole coursework, there's Roger Scruton, English smart guy, has some on the culture of fakes. And it's not a coincidence he used the word fake media, because it was being used in some philosophical circles 20 years ago. And now it's coming out. Whatever's coming out, remember, the issue is not the issue. Whatever's coming out into the public has been seething in the background for at least 20 years, maybe longer. But it takes time to come out. It takes a generation almost to move that stuff from the shadows out into the public. So I'm going to play this. This is Stephen Hicks. And this is about 43 minutes in. So he's covered from the 1500s, 1600s on in. And he gets in detail on why communism, Marxism failed, and now we live with postmodernism is very much aligned with neo-Marxism. And he goes into detail about what failed and why it failed and how spectacularly it failed. And so they had to come up with a new strategy. Well, our theory is correct. Now we just got to find a new way to express it. But.
So we're going in this way and we're using language that suggests a new territory, but we're aware of these pitfalls. Okay. Stanley Fish, Duke University professor for a long time, Milton scholar, then actually moved to my state and became the highest paid public employee in the state of Illinois, made more than the governor as a superstar professor at one of the University of Illinois branch campuses. Talking here about deconstruction, he's applying postmodern methods to literary criticism. And the label there for deconstruction is a literary method of applying postmodern techniques to techniques. And the claim is to say, you know, this deconstruction is really pretty great because it relieves me of the obligation to be right. I don't have to worry about being right, right. What does this text really mean? And am I interpreting it right correctly? And should I have arguments and good evidence, right, and so forth? Instead of that objective right criterion, deconstruction just says I just have to be interesting. And what's interesting? Well, that's deuces wild. That's subjective, right?